So salmon jump a lot, naturally. What you do is, if you were doing the plunger, that's not what we called it, I think so, yeah. You'd be at the stern of the boat, right between, because there's a line that attaches to the net. There's a little bit of space before the net starts in the boat. You can just kind of visualize that. So it's necessary to plunge away right between where the boat ends and where the net begins to keep fish swimming there. And so the idea is just to make bubbles and noise. And in theory, this keeps the fish from all swimming out the holes in your net. And sometimes when you do a shore set, when you have, basically when your circle is completed by the shore, so your boat's bow is pointing right at the beach, and you need two plungers, one on front, one on back, and that sucks being bow plunger, because it's an extra long plunger, being much higher from the water. And it's nice to get that little half-hour break, especially when you're the cook, so you can make meals during your plunging break, because Eunice and I would switch off when we do these plungers. But I'll just relate a couple curious stories that I remember about all this. One was one of these times that we were at Neptune and we were all just miserable and not wanting to do it. It was really foggy and all of us were just inside and Brad was the only one outside. I kind of brown-nosed. I learned to brown-nose as time went on, and I really tried to brown-nose on the Anna Maria, but it never did any good. It almost backfired sometimes. And usually I'd be out there with Brad spotting fish, looking for jumpers. Soon go get our net around him. But this one day, it was totally, completely foggy. It was just very, you couldn't see more than 100 feet practically in front of you. So we were just all inside, just sitting there drinking hot cocoa and bullshitting about something or doing our own stuff. And Brad comes down, oh God, we're never going to catch any fish if you guys are all in here, you know, come on, let's get out. He had, I'm trying to remember what his phrase was, he'd be something like, come on, I mean, are we going to fish or not, or, you know. So Mac, on the Anna Maria, his phrase was all, hey, that's not making me any money. That was his absolute favorite. I forgot what Brad's was, but it was something along the lines of, you know, he's not entirely forthwith with everything. So it's going to be something like, sometimes I feel like I'm the only one who wants to make any money here, you know, who wants to go fishing. So you can see, right there is probably the difference, the essential difference between Brad and Mac. Brad's got softer edges. So we're all sitting inside, and he comes down. Everyone get out. And for me, it was a real process to get suited up. Because I had, second week I was there, I got a very strange rash along my forearms. Just hundreds of these disgusting little lumps. It looked like little mosquito bites. It was about that size. It didn't really itch much, but it covered both my arms up to the elbows. And I was like, ugh. And it was somehow caused by salmon juice. Because when you're pitching fish there, you'd always have water to be flowing up and down your forearms. So in order to really avoid this, what I did is I went out and bought these wrist protectors that were really great. And they're sort of like a urethane foam, let's say it's sort of like a rubberish wrist protector that goes up your forearm, looks really macho. And I put that on, then I put my glove over that, those orange special gloves, and then seal the whole thing off with a little, like a kind of thing, a Velcro strap. And this took a good 5-10 minutes to get all geared up there. And so finally, we all get geared up and we set out. Eunice and I are out on the deck and we're gonna be ready to do the next set. Finally we get out there 10 minutes. Brad looks around and says, "Ah, too foggy, can't see shit." Everyone get back inside. So we all kind of groaned and went back inside. That's all you can do. I mean, on a fish, the captain is the dictator. He has to be pleased and do not make fun of him. Although I did learn on a couple of instances. Really, that sometimes you have to, and it's weird. Because I tend to be pretty unemotional. I do blow up from time to time, but it is few and far between. I mean, I'm talking in periods of years between when I really just scream or do something like that. And the thing is, with our cooking in this place, was always, it always took a really long time. Because it wasn't until the last week we realized, oh, hey, wait a second. You know, Brad came down and cleaned out the stove, because one day I couldn't even get it lit. And he came down and cleaned out the stove, and it was just, then it was really burning. But before that, it would just take me forever to get anything done. I was a cook, so it was my fault. So I'd put on a pot of water, and I figured it'd be boiling in 20 minutes. So I'd say, okay, dinner will be in an hour. And an hour later, the water still wouldn't be boiling. So I was notorious for always misguessing when dinner would be ready. And it was one of these things where I was trying to boil a lot of water for spaghetti. And I think I had said it would be out, you know, it was going to be ready an hour ago or something. And it was taking like 3 hours to even get the water boiling. And so we were all, the thing is, you just have to keep on doing sets while you're waiting for dinner to be served. So it was there spoiling, and you know, Brad said, oh, where's dinner? You know, it's taking you over 3 hours to do it. And so then I just blew up. And the thing is, it was on purpose. It was specifically on purpose, because I was just sort of testing out a theory. I mean, mostly I'm pretty mellow when people just complain and bitch, but I was finding out on the boat that if you really don't scream every once in a while, just everyone ignores you. So what I said was, well, maybe if I get the fucking water to boil, we'd ever have some dinner. Or something, you know, something like, maybe it was the stove could work. You know, then we could boil the water, and blah, blah, blah. So I put the blame on the boat, which indirectly puts the blame on him, but relieves it from me. So, you know, and then, and it's funny because Brad realized exactly, I think, what I was doing. I don't think he realized it was on purpose, but you know, then it's just the way humans talk in code, because then he comes down and then he wants to do then is put himself on my side without, you know, directly apologizing or anything. And so what he says is something along the lines of, well, you know, he comes down, and when it finally all right, he's like, yeah, you know, I try to get this stove to work, and sometimes it takes me forever to get it going, and blah, 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 blah. So then what it was, and this has happened other times occasionally when I really would blow up, because it's such a high stress thing that this is the only time I was emotionally ever I don't think I ever got to the point with Brad that I did with Mac. When with Mac, I was ready to throw him off the boat. I was waiting for him to physically strike me so that I could throw him off the boat. Although with Brad, there certainly was that from time to time. Although I didn't realize how good I had it when he was my captain. And so from time to time, to make me feel better, sometimes if I'd blow up, he'd say, well, you know, I understand that you're doing a lot of work, because I was the cook. I mean, I did all the meals. Of course, I was only two. Basically, everyone was on their own breakfast. I was the only one who really ate breakfast. I never drank coffee. I didn't drink coffee once on all three boats, which was partly a reflection of my own constitution, but mostly a reflection on the fact that I got a good night's sleep every night. I mean, I talked, you know, I kind of bitch about the amount of money I made, but there's a lot of people who just had some fucking miserable times. They were just working 40-hour shifts and such. And we never did an all-nighter. Never once. I think the latest we probably worked was 2 a.m. That was it. We'd be back out the next morning at 7 or something, but that was the latest we worked. But I'm trying to remember exactly this one incident. And yes. As I was cook, I was the one who had to go out and buy all the food every week, and pretty much I always bought the same thing. I mean, dinner would usually be two nights of shake and bake chicken, one night of spaghetti, one night of casserole, sometimes one night of that potatoes and meat thing. I mean, one night I really tried to cook a good meal. It was like the second week or something. I made chicken Oahu. You know, I browned the chicken on the range and had this cool broth going and served all over a bed of rice. And it was, had pineapples in it. And all they all really liked it. They're like, don't you ever spend this long on dinner again, because it took me like 3.5 hours or something. And I got all stressed out when I was doing it. But so the thing is, I'd go out and I'd buy things, and so it'd also be my role to figure out what the boat needed. It's like one, I think, pretty close to the end, maybe, you know, I said 5 weeks. This would have been like the fourth week or something. I noticed, or the third week, I noticed we were, we needed a couple things. We needed a cutting board, because we didn't have a really counter we could cut on. We needed a couple extra glasses, tumblers, because a couple had broken, and an extra fork, because we only had four forks. We had four people, we had exactly four forks. And I forgot the fork. I got the tumblers, and I got the other thing, but I forgot the fork. So the thing is, Brad would always be the last one down for dinner. You know, I'd serve it to the us three, and then Brad would finally come down, we'd serve him. And they were big, pretty big dinners. And there's a lot of food involved, usually with when they had shake. Like this one particular night we had, this is one of the biggest, we had potatoes, chicken, salad, some sort of vegetable dish, and then little breads on the side. I mean, I learned about the wonders of amazing 10-minute food, and those little Pillsbury things you just throw in the oven are one of those wonders. Although I'd always burn them uniformly. but he came down one night, so we were already eating, and he comes down, and he's like, where's a fork? And because there's only four forks, I think we'd used it at lunch or something, so I had to go and wash one out of the sink. But it was no problem. And so, you know, it took an extra minute or something, and he's sitting down there. And then I guess, you know, he must have had something going on, because he looks at me, he's like, I can't believe, you know, you could not get a fork. And I'm like, well, this is ridiculous. So I say, well, the boat has been around now for the last, I don't even know for how many years it has not had five forks. It's only had four. And things have seemed to go pretty well, right? You know, so things have gone fine for the last couple of years with only four forks. You know, you're still catching fish and such. And so he's got a little bit, and then he goes, well, look, I don't see why you have to be so sarcastic, because, you know, I'm just trying to raise a point that, you know, we don't have this extra fork here, and then you just, you know, go and you're being also sarcastic, which is really funny, because Brad was really a sarcastic guy. I mean, smart enough to be sarcastic. I can't remember what I said. I mean, I think I got a little bit more teed off at that point and said something else. And then this is when he had one of these things like, well, okay, I realize you're doing a lot of shit here and you're not always getting thanked for it. Because Eunice and I did not get along at all. Like the second week, third week, or first and second week, I was just completely hostile to him. And it wasn't until later that I realized, I mean, I had to work with the guy. And see, the thing is and I was just bad. I mean, there wasn't anything to be gained. I think I was hoping, I mean, he was smoking a lot of pot, and I was hoping that Brad would kick him off the boat, you know, hear us arguing, kick him off the boat. The thing is, Brad knew that he was smoking pot, I think, but he knew that he was the only decent fisherman among us, so he didn't really say anything, and I can't blame Brad. I mean, he did the right thing. But it's just curious to see, because I learned a lot from that experience, because now I'm in Kennecott, and there's definitely a couple people I don't like. But there's just no need to confront them, and I should have realized that. There was absolutely nothing to be gained by confronting Eunice, nothing whatsoever, and a lot to be lost, because it made it more of an acrimonious work situation. But it was funny, like, I got sick, there's a lot of people, and usually it's just the people I don't like that do this, but talk for the sake of hearing themselves talk, and I know that could in many ways apply to me. But I mean people who, if you're just sitting there reading the paper, will just need to start saying something. Or it just, if you're doing anything, you know, they'll just want to start talking to you. And actually, Tim, one of the guys who lives in Thorpe's place occasionally, he's like this just horribly. Anything he's doing, you can be sitting there reading the newspaper, minding your own business, eating your cereal. He'll just blather on about something. If he can coax you into conversation about what he's doing that day, he'd love to do that. And he's lost so many brain cells. He's an idiot. He's just a moron because he just smokes dope constantly. But the thing is, if he can coax you into this conversation, then he'll just blather on about whatever he's doing. And sometimes if you're like, hey, you know, I'm trying to read or something, then he'll just do it quietly, and you'll just hear like, so basically there's like three levels of it. You know, if you don't want to talk to him, then he's just going to be going, oh, I'm going to the store today and I'm going to buy some oranges. you know. And then, well, I guess here you could accomplish with show it in three level. You know, you'd be sitting there and eating your cereal. And you'd say, "Hey, Yost, you know, what are you up to?" He'd say, "Oh, I'm not much, much up to much." And he'd say, "Oh, well, I'm gonna go down to the store and buy some oranges." But then if you ignore him, he says, "Hey, Yost, you know, like, you know, you just don't pay no attention to him." Then he'd say, "Oh, gotta go buy oranges and gotta go to the store and get some milk." And the third level would be if you're like, "Look, I'm trying to read the paper. Just shut up." Then you just hear mumbling in the background constantly of him going, "Oranges and milk." He's like not able to conceptualize this without vocalizing it. So Eunice was kind of like this, and I was, you know, I was just wishing he'd leave me alone. I got sick because he was a Martian, and I've written this in journal form, and so that's down already. But what I ended up doing is I went out specifically and bought Ulysses, by James Joyce, just in the hope that whenever he started to talk, I could just whip this book out and he'd shut up. And it worked pretty well. But unfortunately, it was fucking Ulysses. So it was not. The first 20 pages weren't bad. If I went really slow, I almost had the sense of discovery while reading it. But after that, I was just lost. So it kind of backfired. But then by the end, I really had understood more. And I was able just to say, "Oh, well, Eunice, you know, what's on your mind?" And I learned a lot by having him talk. And I've learned that more in Kennecott, because this is what I was trying to say before, is that there's a lot of people here I just don't like at all. I can think of two right away, being Lars and Joanne. And I don't know how things with Lars are today specifically, because I took him on a tour, and I was really kind of Columboing him. But, and I'll go over that later. But the thing is that I've learned that you don't gain anything by confronting these people. If there is something to gain, there's a reason to confront someone. You know, if you have to live with someone, maybe. Well, that didn't work with Eunice, because he wasn't about to change. he was a space alien. But I mean, with a lot of people here, I've realized there's just no. I mean, there's a phrase I think someone told me I liked, which was, "Always shake your enemy's hand, because then you know at least what one of them is doing." That's part of it, and part of it is just that it's not worth your own heartache to confront these people. So you just, you know, you have a sort of blowing off relationship with them where you make them think you're interested in anything they have to say, but you just pretty much just blow them off. And I've been here now 3 weeks, and there's a lot of warring factions and groups involved here. But I've managed to stay really neutral, and you know, no one has particularly strong affections for me. I think they get along with me, but no one has particularly negative affections either. So that's a good thing. Okay, I'm going to record some thoughts on Mac McCroskey. Well, I'm just going to say, I mean, I'm never going to get. I mean, the thing is, I did not write my fishing experiences down at the time, and I think it's because they were uniformly negative. I really didn't want to dwell on them. I shouldn't say uniformly negative. I think there's some positive things came of both. And, well, fuck, what else do I need to say, except it's 1 year later, I'm going back to school. And I think I really see the errors of my way in the past. Although I am fucking nervous about it. I'm going back to school, but that's another subject for another time. Now, Mac McCroskey was curious, because I got off the boat with Brad, and I was like, that's it, I'm never saning again. Saning is just boring, stupid, stressful, and dull, all at the same time. I mean, that's all fishing is, I think. Occasionally you get a big set, but you're usually too fucking tired to even get into it. And the things I don't think we ever had. We had a couple big sets, but, excuse me, nothing huge. Nothing huge that really got us excited, especially when you're longlining. So the thing after Brad was like, no, I'm not saying again. I want a long line. And I went down to Flap and Julie, who ran this like fishing brokerage placement service in Homer, with Melissa at the travel agency, who I had a crush on, but she didn't really like me, so that was pretty much that. But rather, what happened is, I went there and I said, okay, no more saning. And Julie and I got along really well. And I said, no more saning, give me something more interesting to do. And she lined up for me. She said, oh, we've got this guy who's going fishing out in Area 4B, out in the Aleutians. So I'm like, wow, fucked up, I'll do that. You know, that sounds exciting because I get to go out to the Aleutians. So, and she says he's a family friend. His name is Mac McCroskey. I was like, oh, that's interesting. And he's got a wife named Jean who worked at the Eagle. And so I go home and I start talking to Mike about this because we were both living in Brad's boat in dry dock. And I tell Mike about it. Mike sort of read about it also on the door of the Catch My Gear shed. And so he's like, yeah, let's do that. And I was sort of leery. I didn't want to bring Mike along because he's, I mean, a liability in many ways because Brad didn't really like him. I didn't want to associate myself. I mean, it's self-serving, granted. But I knew that Brad definitely had his qualms with Mike, and I didn't want to go into a new boat saying, yeah, well, it's going to be me and my buddy here. You know, I was trying to bill us as different, although we worked on the last boat together. That was the image I tried to portray. So I tell Mike about this, and he's like, that sounds like fun. You know, that'll be good. We'll go do that. So we interviewed with Mac on the phone. He called us once from the Aleutians, and then I talked to Gene as well. What was interesting is that I've forgotten what I was going to say, and that was interesting. Oh, well, he had once said, well, you know, I've been fishing for a really long time, so ask anyone about me. So I went down to the gear shed, and I asked one of these guys, you know, Mac McCroskey, and he was like, he's a real character, because his wife, Gene, is so nice and proper, and just always looks so, so nice, but Mac just looks like he rolled out of a bilge. That was pretty funny. The bilge is the low point of the ship where all the crap collects and then gets pumped out from the bilge pump, but a pretty toxic area. So I was just stoked to be going longlining. I really wanted to do this. And I think actually by the time we got out there, Mac said, well, you know, Gene mentioned that even if you're not the most experienced crew, you're probably the most enthusiastic because I really wanted to be there. And so we go out to the plane and we get round trip tickets and take us out to the Aleutians. Oh, fuck. Or actually, you can take us out to Dutch Harbor and then we're going to. No, I'm sorry. You can take us to the Aleutians. Directly out to the Aleutians. What am I saying? Yeah, to Dutch, which I guess is the Aleutians. Okay, I'm being silly. But as a curious little side note here, I see this one woman in the airport who I'm instantly drawn to for whatever reason. I'm like, She's attractive, but also looks somewhat self-confident. And I just see her in the airport in, I must have been Homer. Yeah, because I wouldn't have gone to. Yeah, wait. I think what happened is I saw her in Homer. And I talked to her for a minute or two, because she was getting on the plane going to Anchorage, I think. Not sure if I talked to her then or not. But what was really curious, because we must have flown to Anchorage and then flown to Sandpoint from there. What was curious is because I kind of noticed her. She was one person who just stuck out, and then she actually happened to be on the same flight. And I think that was curious, I think, because I must have talked to her in Anchorage rather than having talked to her in Homer. Well, she was from Homer, so maybe it was a combination of both. But nevertheless, her name is Leslie Mastic. Just beautiful, short, but beautiful. Very self-confident business owner. And she owned Homer's Jeans back in Homer. And you know, the curious thing is I can never figure out why. I was having absolutely no luck with women, but I had this ridiculous looking red beard during this whole period of my life. So I must remember that as a subcurrent. But I started talking to her on the plane, and she was nice, and she was actually going out to the Aleutians as well. Yes, we started talking to Homer. That was the curious thing, is we were going to the exact same spot. We're going to Anchorage, then to Cold Point, then to Cold Bay, and then to Sandpoint, and then Sandpoint, Cold Bay, whatever it is, then out to Dutch. So I started talking to her. We got along really well. And I'm not sure if she was kind of attracted to me or not. It seemed sort of like it, but it's tough to say, and it doesn't really matter. Although I'd like to write her a letter sometime if I could scrounge up her address. So I start talking to her, and, you know, finally we all arrive in Dutch, and I meet Mac, and he's this cute little looking 75-year-old man without any teeth, And he's all smiles when he shows up. So I'm talking to Leslie, and my last thing I impart to her is, God, don't I have a cute captain? And she kind of laughs, and then we part ways, and oh, I see her, a month later or something. But Mac was just all smiles, nicer than hell. We get there, and he insists on, we all drive out to Eagle, which is out there, and Dutch is weird. They've got two shopping centers, they've got AC, the Amasca commercial, and then the Eagle right next to each other, practically, just down the street from each other. Big supermarkets. And he's like, yeah, let's go out and get some food. And we ate well. I mean, we ate, I think, fried chicken, and, it wasn't very healthy, but we ate a lot. He was like, you gotta have a really, you gotta really good fuel your crew to eat well. And we're gonna eat really well. And I was like, oh, thank God. And he really liked cooking, so I was just in heaven. I was, yes, couldn't be happier. And so I have really positive, and he's like, yeah, let's drive around Dutch. So we drive around Dutch that day. And what's curious is we're going to be in Dutch Harbor for a couple of days, a week or something before we go out, or 4 days before we go out. Things start to change. And part of my personality that I'm only starting to change now is I used to think it was really good to ask lots of questions. If you're never not sure of anything, just ask a question. It just takes a second to ask a question, and people are more than happy to answer it. And the thing is that he hates questions. And it was a fundamental part of my personality at this point. So I wasn't ever 100% sure. I just ask a question. Even if I could figure it out by my thinking for a second, I just ask a question. It was done. And in some ways, that's good. But in some ways, it was really bad. And one of the ways was the fact that he hated it. So he'd tell me something, and sometimes I'd ask him a question basically to verify that, and that'd really piss him off. Even irrationally so, it should not have. Because for me, it's a question of clarity. I'm just not 100% sure. I just want to make sure. But to him, it was just, anathema, and he hated it. It was the worst possible thing you could do to him. So, having the first couple days, a couple things, but, something like there was a miscommunication where I might have said, or he might have understood that I was going to clean something out, and I didn't. He was like, well, I thought you were going to clean this out, and then he just stare at me. But then the two big things that happened that really turned him from being the smiley old man, one was, we started arguing about blacks and whites, and he was saying something about blacks being inherently more violent or something. And I was arguing him on that because I don't think it's true. I mean, certainly there's statistics to show there's more black people creating crime, but I don't think it's any genetic predisposition they have towards violence. And so we start arguing about this, and we get into it pretty well. And that's the other thing. At the time, I didn't understand you don't argue with your captain, because Brad and I would always argue. But Mac didn't like to be argued with. So I was arguing with him. And see, at that point, from then on, I became the college kid who thought he knew a lot about everything but didn't know shit about shit, which to an extent is true, I guess. But at least I thought I knew something about this. And the curious thing is, because after this, he did sort of the good human thing, and he tries to make sure that everything's cool after the argument. He says, well, everyone always talks about diplomacy, but I'd be a shitty diplomat because diplomacy is just compromising what you believe in. And then, what I do then is, the other thing is to smooth that over even more, and I say, oh, well, that's a good thing, because it's good you don't compromise your morals, and you're right, you'd be a shitty diplomat because you believe too much in what you believe in. So that was kind of like, hey, it's cool with me, it's cool with you, and everything was cool, but it wasn't. And I didn't realize that, and I fucked up seriously by getting into this argument with him, and I should have just shut up. And that's what I did as time went on. And he'd blather on about, all about social issues, fishing issues, government issues, whatever it's going to be. I think one of the only ones I can remember was him talking about how illegal immigrant mothers were to blame for the collapse of Social Security or something. Yeah, that was it. They were coming over here and they were getting on Social Security and bankrupting it. And instead of rich old fucks like him who took their checks every day, every month, even though they didn't deserve it, or didn't need it, rather. So that's the thing. And the other time something happened was Mike and I were sitting inside the boat, and we were just sitting there talking. Mac was outside doing something, and all of a sudden there's this huge crash. We're like, oh, I wonder what that is. And he comes inside, and he's quiet and pissed off, and he's, let me make something very clear. Whenever you see or hear me out there doing something, you're going to be there as well, helping me. And so I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. But the thing is, I'm always used to people asking for help, but I didn't realize this about Brad, that he was very good about that. That if he had to go down and work on the engines, he'd be like, Yos. He'd say, Yos, I need you to sit here for 15 minutes, but first I need a screwdriver, paper towels, and spray shit. That was his word for lubricant. And he'd be like, okay, you're here for until we fix this. And that was fine. I had absolutely no problem with that. And I didn't realize at the time, but it was cool, because he told me exactly what he wanted. But Brad's, or Max, suffered from what we call Captain Bullshit Syndrome, which is the complete inability to say what you want, and just to have people have to, like, divine it. So from that point on, I realized that he would never ask us for help on anything. We were just supposed to magically assume what he wanted done. And part of it was easy. Just when he was out on the deck there, you'd be out on the deck. But it just got ridiculous, because I got really browbeaten through this whole thing. And I respect Mike, because he was able to stay above it. And what was weird is, like, I took it all personally. Like, fuck, Max pissed at me, and I must, you know, compensate by being a great guy on the boat here. So I really went the extra mile, for the most part, that when he went out to the deck, even if he's fucking taking a pee, you know, I'd sit there and I'd watch him, make sure he wasn't going to do anything else. And so it seriously came time, from time to time, he'd go out there to take a pee, and I'd, you know, follow him right back out on the deck. It was ridiculous. But see, the thing is that Mike, throughout this entire experience, really just ignored almost everything Max said, completely. And he just ignored Mac entirely. And Mac would yell at me and say, oh, you know, whatever. And I was like, oh my God, Mac's yelling at me. This is the end of the world. This is horrible. So by the end, you know, I was expecting maybe I'd get, because he dicked us. He told us we were going to get 10%. Then he told us 8% when we got to the Illusions. I told this to Brad. He's like, you should have walked out. And I should have, because I talked to Brad once or twice after I got back. And I really should have. I should have just said, fuck this. But I didn't. I stayed on. So the day we signed our contracts, it said 8% right there. And he was like, well, if you want to step off the boat, you can. Because he said, you guys just aren't as experienced as I thought you were. And fuck that, because we told him exactly how experienced we were. Well, I made a few stupid mistakes, because I wasn't as good dying up the boat, for sure, as I should have been. But he was the kind of guy to overreact to everything. That's the way captains are. They scream a lot. Universally, they scream. So he suffers from CBS, which was Captain Bullshit Syndrome. And it was weird, because I just took it all too much to heart. I was like, God, how can I make Mac like me? How can I make 10% of my contract? You know, how can I get this really to work out? And I had little things like, I will sit out on the deck. I'll be the last one. That was my little game, was I'll be the last one inside the cabin each night. You know, whatever we're doing, I'll be the last one there. You know, I'll take the longest to do anything. And I'm not sure how long that lasted, but it certainly didn't last to the end. So the combination of those two events really changed the tenor of the entire experience. And from then on, it was basically there'd be the periods where Mac would not be screaming, and the periods where he'd be screaming. It would be where he wasn't mad yet, and the periods where he'd be mad. And there was really not any middle ground there. And so I was getting increasingly frustrated, because we hadn't even left yet, and we were running into all this bullshit just happening constantly. And there's nothing I could do. It was a completely lose-lose situation. Because I realized, like, once I was going to go out and get a newspaper, and I was like, hey, do you want a newspaper? He was like, no, I'm going to get my own newspaper. It doesn't make any difference. I said, all right. I went out, came back with my own newspaper. Or no, actually, I read my newspaper there. And then I left it. I think I left it at the supermarket, or I gave it to someone. And then came back, and he said, well, where's the newspaper? I said, well, he said he didn't want it. And then he mumbled something, which was like, well, I can see, you know, how much I matter here or something. I said, pardon? Because I knew I was in the right, and he knew I was in the right. But he was like, oh, nothing, you know. So I could tell there's nothing I could do to win this, because the fucker was senile. So it was before we even went out. It took us, I think, a good 4 days to get out to where we were going, because we were going all the way out to Atka for this opener. And I was like, ah, and I haven't even mentioned Robert yet. Now, Robert was the last guy in this whole operation. Robert was half native, and Mac had met him out in Dutch. And he, when I first met him, was my same opinion of Mac. You know, here he is toothless, he was missing his front 2 teeth, grinning. I really liked him. He seemed like a really agreeable guy. Really easygoing native fellow. And knew his fishing. He had been doing a lot of long lining with Snap-on gear. And so I had done Snap-on gear my first opener, so we kind of discussed that. And we had a little bit in common, and it got along great. So, and he was sort of the mellowing influence that, I mean, he it was weird because I think Mac wanted to make him kind of the first mate idea, sort of what Dan was back on the first boat I worked on, whatever that was, the Dolly B. But what came out in the end is that he was a shitty fisherman, and in many ways I was better than him. I'm not just saying that, it's because when we'd tie skates, I'd find some of his skates would be left tied poorly, and I would get universally blamed for this stuff because Mac didn't realize that he was just not a good fisherman. And especially like when we were tying off ganions onto the skates, when we had to make a new skate, he couldn't tie a ganion knot, and he wouldn't listen to me of how to do it because he was really proud. And it was a problem because he was really doing stuff wrong. And I'd try to tell him, you know, hey, you're doing this, you know, can you just do it this way? And be like, no, you know, or he'd just say, yeah, that's how I am doing it, you know. And so then we'd have work that would be done shitty. And part of it was, you know, it wouldn't bother me as much as long as Mac understood that it wasn't me, because I was the one where shit was universally being dumped on, and I was sick of it. And I was like, look, I'm working my ass off here. And so when Robert was sloppy, it really pissed me off. So we finally head out, and then I'm like, okay, now things will be better, because now, once I start to work, once he sees that I'm going to work my ass off for him, he can't possibly be as mad at me. And so we head out, and the second day on the boat, because I had never been on a boat for 3 weeks straight or whatever it was going to be. And I told him this, you know, and I actually first before we even left, I was going to look for some seasickness things. He was like, well, you know, you better not eat any. I was like, well, I guess you're right. So the second night out there, I get really sick. Because we're going in about 10-foot waves, just plowing right through these fuckers. And all the beds are right, you know, right by the bow. All the beds in these boats are always curled right along the bow. So I'm sitting there, and we're just crashing through the waves, just thunk, 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 thunk. And I'm just lying in my bed going, oh, God. We had halibut hamburgers for lunch. And I'm like, I feel so sick. And I sat there, and it's the same thing when you're sick with the fever or something. You know, I didn't want to fall, or I couldn't, I was stuck, you know, I couldn't decide whether to get up or stay there. So I sat there, and I didn't want to throw up, I just wanted to lay there and let it pass, but kind of these things never pass. So I was trying to visualize a very straight area, and actually I was visualizing Hooper O'Sara Road by my house in Stanford. It was weird because it helped, and I just visualized walking down this patch of road I knew very well, and it was totally straight. And I could concentrate on that. But then I just, it wasn't working very well. And I came upstairs, and I decided to drink a couple glasses of water. So I drank a glass of water, and I sat there. And it, because I decided I would force it, because I wasn't ready to puke yet, and I would force it. And the best thing to force is to stay inside a stuffy hot cabin. So I stayed there for about, oh, all of 2 minutes, and then said, I've got to go. So I went out on the deck of the boat and just heave my fucking guts out like 10 times of all these halibut burgers right into the Bering Sea, and it was kind of cool. Just puking, puking, puking. And I think Mike was there too, and he wasn't throwing up or anything because he'd been on boats for years, but he gave me a napkin and a little bit to drink, and after I threw up, that was really it. I was like, argh, it was great. I was totally ready to fish because I'd puked my guts out. I was like, is that the best you can do? You know, come on, fish, I'm ready. So I came in, I just felt great when I came in. I was like, yeah, you know, if that's the worst it's going to get, I can take this in 10 times more. So we're all sitting there, and we're sitting around, and it was funny, because I think three of us were trying to, we were all talking about what it was, and like Robert said, oh, you know, first time on a boat, and Mike said, oh, you know, first time in the Bering Sea or something, and Max said, bad fish, bad fish for lunch, and so it was funny, you know, we were all laughing, and it was in a really good mood.